Greetings and welcome to Black Alumni Weekend and today's seminar, The Dream Fulfilled. Unfortunately, Julian Bond is a little bit under the weather, so he won't be here today, but we will continue with the panel. We want to turn it into more of an open discussion, so please get involved. Our speakers for the day are Mr. Tim Lovelace and Tomiko Brown Nagin. Tim Lovelace graduated from the University of Virginia in 2003 and received a bachelor's with distinction in American politics. He graduated from the Virginia School of Law in 2006. Today, Tim is a governor's fellow and doctoral student in history at the University of Virginia, where his research examines how civil rights activism in the American South informed the development of international human rights law. Prior to her teaching position at the University of Virginia School of Law, Tomiko Brown Nagin received a doctorate in history from Duke and a law degree from Yale. She received her bachelor's summa cum laude from Furman University. Tomiko Brown Nagin teaches courses on American social and legal history, constitutional law, education law and policy, and public interest law. Currently, Tomiko Brown Nagin is working on a book, Courage to Dissent, about lawyers, courts, and community-based activism during the civil rights era. Welcome.
Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. So Professor Bond is not here, unfortunately, but we want to have a really sort of conversational tone about this question of the dream being fulfilled. There's been a lot of discourse about this, easily for the last 6 months, but probably longer than that. We can probably go back to Jeremiah Wright, which is more than a year ago. And so the sort of structure of this, I'll ask Professor Brown Nagin several questions, and then we're going to open it up to question and answer to sort of get a discussion going. We want to have a critical discourse. It's important to celebrate this moment. Let's say this at first. It's important to celebrate this moment. America has come very far in some ways, right? The notion of having a black president, people say, you know, I couldn't imagine having an African-American president in my lifetime. Well, you couldn't have imagined this probably 4 years ago, right? And so that says a lot about this sort of moment. I think it's important to sort of celebrate that piece. At the same time, this is democracy, right? We have to, and we're in the academy, right? So we have to be able to interrogate Obama, President Obama, right, in some spaces. So we want a space in which we both celebrate and we both interrogate as well. And so your questions will help to make this a fruitful conversation, but we'll start first with Professor Brown Nagin.
Let's talk about this idea of the dream. Has a dream been fulfilled? Obama is invoking, in many times, King's language in his acceptance speech. He's riffing off of King, and lots of political pundits are making this analogy. Has the dream been fulfilled?
Thank you, Tim, and thank all of you for coming out here today and joining us. I should start off by saying that we, of course, all are very disappointed that Professor Bond could not be here today, and we wish him a speedy recovery. On this question of whether the dream has been fulfilled, I'll echo Tim's comments by first saying that, of course, the election of President Obama, the nation's first African-American president, is tremendously significant. And it's easy to see it as the culmination of the struggle for the right to vote that started so many years ago, picked up steam after World War II, and it was a struggle that, of course, Dr. King led very far, Julian Bond led very far. All of those civil rights heroes and heroines, they struggled for the right to vote. They believed in representative democracy, to have President Obama in office is certainly the culmination of that legacy in many ways. But it is not in and of itself the dream. An election, winning an election, even for an African American, is not in and of itself the dream. First of all, one has to pause and consider that race mattered in the election. President Obama won 43% of the white vote, and yet in the South, he only won Virginia. And in some southern states, and North Carolina, in Alabama, he won 10% of the vote, which was half of what John Kerry achieved in the prior election. So it seems very clear that for some people, it was difficult to pull that lever for an African American candidate. So race mattered. It also is true that a very unusual set of circumstances propelled the president into office. I remember reading a satirical newspaper that had this headline saying, black man gets worst job in the world, which was a way of saying that, you know, this is an extraordinary time, that people were hungry for change, that people were tired of the prior administration that was considered a disaster by many measures. So race mattered in that way. Moving to more substantive matters, when Dr. King talked about the dream, he was not just talking about a colorblind democracy. He was talking about things like adequate housing, equal schools, living wages for African Americans in general. And if you speak in those terms, there's been a lot of improvement since the 1950s and 60s, and yet in all of these areas, there continues to be a black-white gap. So there is a healthcare gap. There is an employment gap. So the black employment unemployment rate continues to be twice that of whites. There is an achievement gap that we've all heard about. There is an incarceration gap. So, you know, when you think about the substance of the matter, I think you have to come to the conclusion that no, the dream has not been achieved.
Okay. We want to talk about substantive issues that may not get talked about within the sort of conventional political discourse. We want to talk about the cabinet. President Obama has made a sort of great stride to unify the nation, right? This idea of unity after 8 years of disunity has been one of the sort of guiding points of his appointment. So you have Republicans like Robert Gates. You have someone who's economically conservative like Larry Summers on President Obama's economic team. But then you also have Eric Holder, right, who's talking about the nation, that America's a nation of cowards that doesn't want to talk about race enough. What do we think about the cabinet and President Obama's cabinet selections? Do his appointments reflect a commitment to civil rights? Or is it even fair to ask this question of someone who's in this position? How do we sort of navigate that space and think about that?
Right. That's a really good question. On the cabinet is very diverse. It's one of the most diverse cabinets ever. That said, there are few veterans or known quantities in the traditional civil rights community. Among his appointees, with a few exceptions, the president just nominated Tom Perez, who is from Maryland, to the position of assistant attorney to the Civil Rights Division in DOJ. Cassandra Butts is heading the EEOC. She used to work at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And there are a few others. But I think it's fair to say that there's reason to be cautiously optimistic on the cabinet. It's very diverse, and one would assume that President Obama has commitments to civil rights and plans on actualizing them. But the advocacy community has to look to an agenda and to results, right? So that's what people need to keep their eyes on. Whether the administration follows through on initiatives that it puts forth and whether it listens to the advocacy community. And you asked a question about whether the civil rights community should feel entitled to weigh in. Of course they should feel entitled to weigh in, right? The president himself has said that he wants to hear from everyone. And certainly he should want to hear from this very important part of his base. We know that, the banks are an important part of who's being heard these days. And I can't imagine that the civil rights community would not also be an important part. There are interest groups that make it their business always to be heard in Washington. And the civil rights community has to be an interest group along with those others, as it always has been. And it has to continue to do that in this administration and not pull back simply because we have a black president. The president, these are very trying times, obviously, and he's being pushed and pulled in every direction. And one has to get in there and state what one's agenda is, what one needs and what one wants in order to get leverage in the political process. So, yes, the community needs to have voice.
So in thinking about voice, one of the sort of big discussions that surrounded the campaign was the selection of Supreme Court justices. There are probably two, maybe three justices that could be appointed within the next 4 years. What might Obama's selection of Supreme Court justices look like?
Yeah, that's been talked about a lot, and a lot recently, because Justice Ginsburg has been in ill health, and people are very interested and believe that the first nominee will be a woman. There were two women on the court, with Sandra Day O'Connor and Ginsburg, and there is no longer. That may well be the case. He will want to, I would imagine, have a diverse bench. But more importantly, President Obama has been very open about what he's looking for in judges. He has said that he wants judges who will uphold the Constitution, who will be committed to the rule of law, but he's also said that he wants judges who will have empathy, who will know or imagine what it feels like to be a pregnant a black teenager, or to be gay, or to be a woman. He has expressly said that he wants to nominate, appoint judges who have heart. That's pretty extraordinary for him to be so open in saying that. And what he's talking about is that, in most legal cases, they're not hard cases. But in the really hard cases, he's admitting that a judge's values come into play. And he said that he wants to appoint people who will understand the troubles, the struggles that ordinary Americans face. I should note that a lot of people talk about the Supreme Court. The U.S. Courts of Appeal are really important as well, and the president will have the opportunity to remake those courts much more quickly than he can remake the Supreme Court. So currently, there is a partisan advantage. The Republicans occupy, their Republican appointees, I should say, occupy, I think it's 58% of those appellate judge positions. And I've read a report saying that within one term, the president can rebalance those courts and change that to a majority Democrat balance. And this is important because research shows that Democratic appointees, females and minorities, are more sympathetic to civil rights claimants.
The last question before we open this up for comments and questions is to go back to this issue of the achievement gap. President Obama, with his academic pedigree, aspired to the highest ranks of Harvard Law School. And so many people say, if President Obama can do it, I can do it too, this sort of inspirational impact, which is critically important. There was also a study done that came out in January of this year by Ray Friedman, a professor at Vanderbilt, and he saw an Obama effect. Before Obama was elected, there was a black-white achievement gap on a test that he administered. After this election, he sees this gap go away. Interesting. Have we entered a period where we can look to Obama as a way to think about how African Americans may achieve academically in new ways? Are there excuses for African Americans? And many people on the right may say this, that African Americans, the achievement gap is based on excuses. Have we entered this sort of post-racial period of academic achievement?
That's interesting. I read about that study. It didn't strike me as a very well-designed kind of study. I think it was, 20 questions, and it didn't strike me as holding up to scrutiny. That said, obviously, President Obama is an exceptional figure. He's very inspiring. I hope that he inspires African-American students and students of all backgrounds, and I'm sure that he will. And we should, of course, exhort young people to achieve the best that they can. At the same time, I'm puzzled when people talk about African-American student achievement outside of context, talk about the students without reference to social policy and educational policy. So students don't only need role models, they need supportive social networks, they need supportive families, they need excellent schools, they need resources, they need all sorts of things in order to achieve. So the question is, are we as a country committed to giving African-American students those things? And if we are, then let's ask about this question of whether they are living up to their full potential. Now, I can say a few words about Obama's own educational policy and what it might have to offer African-American students. He has talked about a few different things. First of all, the stimulus package contains a lot of money for education, $100 billion, which is double the usual. And he has this Education Secretary Arne Duncan, whom a lot of people like. And they talk about, in addition to the resources, new assessments and accountability, performance pay for teachers, and expanding charter schools. Now, everyone's happy to have additional funds, right? People aren't so happy necessarily to be subjected to the strings that come along with those additional funds, namely the new assessments the Education Department is proposing are harder tests. So there's this idea that under No Child Left Behind, the states are using tests that are very easy in order to comply with the law. So the administration wants harder tests and wants to hold school systems accountable in order to get that money. Performance pay is very controversial as an education reform. It's been around a long time, that initiative, and yet the criticism is that whenever it's tried, it seems to be coupled with high-stakes testing, and it seems to result in a lot of cheating. by principals and teachers who have an incentive to do what they need to do in order to show that students are doing well on these tests. So it's just not clear that students will benefit from performance pay in the way that the administration imagines, although I should say that there are lots of different ways in which to structure performance pay initiatives, and I'm sure that they will try to come up with a very well-crafted system. Then the charter school initiatives. Traditionally, the civil rights community has not supported charter schools because of a fear that they will drain the public school system of resources and of students, the best students. The evidence shows there have been a number of recent studies that for all of the talk of charter schools being these laboratories of innovation and excellence, that the students who attend them aren't actually doing a lot better on average than students who attend public schools. Now, there are some charter schools where students do really well, but there's a question about, where are those schools, who gets to go to them, and how many of them are there? Can that model be replicated? But there are also a lot of charter schools where the students do poorly, that fail, that have to be closed. So one might ask, why the president would endorse this initiative that there's a lot of questions about it as an education reform tool. It's not clear that it would pay off in the final analysis in the way that he hopes to.
Great. So we want to open this period up to your comments and your questions for each other, for the panelists as well. So, we'll start by raising hands. Yes, sir.
Quick comment and question perhaps on my observations as a parent.
My concern looking at the reforms of public school versus charter schools versus private school, I think on the whole, our private school systems have a number of shortcomings in not so much treating all students fairly, but treating entire regions fairly. I am of the opinion, and it may be rather simplistic, that if we give the funds to public school systems, hire teachers who care and teach well and bring that innovation to the classroom within the public school system and maintain the students' interest, you will have less need for charter schools to develop that type of interest. I went to high school in a pretty interesting part of South Central Los Angeles, where we had way, way back in the day, before a lot of the folks heard about them, Crips started when I went to school in Inglewood, California. I was there for the initiation of drive-bys and all that stuff, but still in my school, where we had deaf on a regular basis, we had teachers that came to school every day, cared about the students, would actually do anything and everything they could to make sure the students graduated. We had a very high placement of graduating seniors into college, and a number of my peers were very, very successful across the country and other parts of the world today because of not necessarily the school system, but because of individual teachers. We've also seen the flip side of that, where you have very good schools, very high-end private schools, we're paying a lot of money for tuition, but the teachers are simply making time. The students are losing out. They are not getting the benefit of the price of the tuition because the teachers are more concerned with leaving early, getting home, taking care of their pets than they are staying after school to take care, true story, taking care of the students. Now, my question to you is, and I'm sure that there are some educators as well as some recent high school students here, do you think that a public school system well run with real teachers, and you know the difference between a real teacher and just a regular teacher, you've had professors that are of the same ilk of which I'm speaking,
that take an interest in you personally, make sure that you reach, you don't just achieve what you can achieve, you reach for what is almost beyond your grasp and achieve that. If you have a public school system that allows you to do that as a teacher, an educator, pay them a fair salary to make a living in this economy so that they don't have to worry about paying the rent while they do what they love to do. If that is more effective than a small charter school, which not only bleeds the top students, but also the top educators, away from the public school system, and perhaps even narrowing the necessity for private schools.
You know, you're definitely describing an ideal. But I think that the endorsement of charter schools is premised on this idea that we can't achieve the ideal on the scale that we need to, and thus, why not experiment on a smaller scale and give some opportunity to at least a few students as quickly as we can? Because there's a sense that in metropolitan areas, the bureaucracy is so vast that it's just really, really difficult to make change. So people tout, say, even Arne Duncan and what he was able to do in Chicago, but Chicago has not had any miraculous change in terms of its school system. It sort of depends on how you look at the data and what kind of change you're expecting. I share the concern of a lot of people about charter schools, but at the same time, I think that there are so many impediments to trying to get to where you want to go, but we certainly should try to push forward to that ideal. We should try, and we shouldn't give up on the public schools. There are a lot of people who are not. And I think maybe I'm hearing a concern that the administration's endorsement of charter schools is a kind of endorsement of moving from the public school model to something else.
I guess my comment is twofold. As to what you said, I do agree that public schools would be a lot better as far as the teachers are concerned. But I think with this generation, it's more of a public policy issue. I know for, at least in the state of Virginia, the public schools are funded according to the taxpayers in that area. So even if you have the best and brightest teachers, if you don't have the funding, if you don't have the resources, I don't think the kids are ever going to be able to necessarily compete equally. I would say, for example, I know school systems that every school, except for one, is in a low-income project area. So even if you get the best and bright teachers, even if they are creative, if you have kids that are not able to eat before they go to school or were up all night because of things that go on in their family life, I think we need to focus a little bit more on the structure of how schools are formed, how they get their funding, aid to families, counseling services. I think those will make the biggest difference in schools more than so just hiring better teachers. Because what the teachers are competing against now, I think, are totally different than they were 20, 30 years ago, in my opinion. I guess my second question was to everyone. I'm very elated about President Obama being elected. I think it's an awesome thing. But the flip side of that is I feel that there's this notion in America that we've all arrived. And that because we have an African-American president, the playing field is ultimately leveled. So it's kind of a catch-22 for me. It's kind of a bittersweet thing because it's that notion when you see that one doctor that says, I grew up in the projects and I made it and I'm a doctor and I'm successful. But then there's 200 other little black boys that grew up in that same project that are not doctors and that are not successful. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't have those same dreams or same aspirations, but every child is different. And there's a difference when it's an anomaly or, you know, when it's just the norm. And I think a lot of times we get wrapped up in anomalies and sort of make blanket statements. So I just was thinking of what everyone else thought about how the presidency affected us in that manner. It's kind of how desegregation affected schools and kind of that whole dichotomy.
Hi, everyone. I hope that my voice is okay, just kind of getting off the road here. And we walked in a little bit late, but as a public school teacher for 11 years, for one of the most prestigious counties in the country, I'm not going to name it, because there are myriad problems that exist within the system. However, one of my main concerns as a high school teacher and as a middle school teacher, one of my main concerns is the lack of rigor for the students in regards to curriculum, in regards to the high stakes testing. And you all may have addressed this prior to my coming in, so if I'm talking about something, if I'm reiterating. But one of the things that I find most frustrating as a dedicated and a very hardworking teacher who really takes pride in honing my craft and really reaching out to that child that you're talking about, that even though I'm in an upper middle class area, but there are kids who come from, you know, Section 8 homes and, you know, single family homes where there's very little income. But one of my biggest concerns, like I was saying earlier, is first of all, the lack of critical thinking that is being required of our students. That's my first problem. And I think that the reason is because our focus is on the wrong thing. Our focus is on numbers, but numbers can be manipulated. And I want to see what that child can do with his mind. I want to see what that child can do in regards to synthesizing and evaluating, you know, like when you think about Bloom's taxonomy, functioning at those higher levels of thinking and performing. And so that's sorely lacking. And as a teacher, like I said, I mean, my husband can attest. I mean, I'm in school full-time right now, thank God. You know, that's a blessing. I'm working on a second master's degree. But as a teacher, you know, one of my biggest concerns was you have all of this focus on these tests. You got kids testing. They get to the point where either they experience a great deal of test anxiety or they just take it as a joke because it's so frequent that it's almost, it is ridiculous. And then you have teachers who feel the pressure, as you were saying earlier, for these incentives or what have you, or for the school to make AYP. So they feel pressure. And so what ends up happening is the teachers should not, but they do, feel the pressure to teach to the test. And then when that happens, out the window goes your critical thinking. But for teachers like myself, who try very hard to implement not only the test-taking strategies that are necessary for our students to succeed, I find myself also supplementing with the curriculum. Because I don't believe that just because the country says, you know, you need to take this test, our kids need to be able to think. You know, our kids need to be able to work cooperatively and to problem solve, you know. And I'm not trying to, you know, I'm very passionate about this, so I'm in the right place today. But I really have a great deal of concern for where our country is going, because a lot of our kids can think, and unless they're with teachers who are pushing them beyond what is the norm or what is expected, what is good enough to make that, to pass that test, they're not even going to be aware that they can think, you know, and that kind of addresses your both of you, really. So I could talk all day about it, but I'm not. But, you know, that's a serious concern. Because then you end up burned out, you know. And you're right, there are teachers who go home to take care of their pets or their husbands or their, and that's fine, take care of your family. You gotta take care of your family. But you have to do your job. And a lot of people don't seem to, I don't know.
First, good afternoon to everybody. I wanted to address the first question about, you know, is the dream fulfilled? And I think it's kind of premature to ask that question, given this, you know, all the different circumstances that we're faced with in our society today. one of, you know, the main things is that, you know, we have to deal with, economic issue. As we continue to work through this issue to figure out where we stand with it, we can't, you know, we have to be cognizant and can't fail to realize that this is not, you know, an administration that is, you know, simply going to be able to go into history as this is our historic value. This is one that has to deal with tangible issues before they can even get to the point of their historic value. And a lot of times as you get to the end of an administration, you look back and you think about the historic value. Oh, what did we do? How do we rank in history? This one is going to be judged on how the not just the economy, but how our country and how our world is bettered by its actions. And one thing that's going to have to deal with is the economy, is healthcare, is education, and simply the fact of, you know, the individualistic thought process of many people. The fact that people, for the most part, don't really, you know, have an opportunity to think about the collective good of society. A lot of times, still in a capitalistic society, what is going on with me? How can I make it? You know, versus how is the society going to make it? Because we have to remember, unless there's this great storm that wipes out all people but you, you're going to have to be concerned with the collective soul, because you work. If you work, you work with someone else. Even if you have a job, your job is, if you have your own business, it's dependent on someone else. If they're not doing their share, or they're not able to commit to your business acumen, then you're going to fail. So ultimately, I think right now what we have to deal with is a great issue of how can we be concerned with the dream being fulfilled when we have to be concerned with, the dream fulfiller. Can he, do the things that he needs to do in order to meet the needs of society before he can realize the great altruistic, possibilities of his policies as it will eventually affect his historic value, his forefathers, those who, paved his way to being in this position. And I think it's very possible, because again, I think this is not just an African American figure. This is somebody who a lot of us, truly have had a chance to study and realize he has, a lot of intangibles to make these things happen. However, I think, as he said in his speeches, that it's not on him alone to believe that he can, solve all these societal ills. So I think when we ask about the dream being fulfilled, we have to ask ourselves, are we willing and ready to help him in, fulfilling that dream? Because if we're ultimately able and willing to help him fulfill that dream, I believe 4, 8, 25, 30 years from now or more, we can come back and say, yeah, I believe, the dream of Dr. King, Frederick Douglass, and so many other figures in our culture has been fulfilled, or can, it's really on its way to being fulfilled.
Hi, good evening, or afternoon. I just want to piggyback off of that because I agree. I feel that the nature of this discussion should be, are we given the opportunity to do the work? And I think before, it didn't seem possible to do the work because we saw so many obstacles in front of us to step towards opening those doors. And I feel that with all the criticism of the stimulus package, the biggest thing that sticks with me is that now we have an opportunity. Now we're giving, now he's not only saying, yeah, we should be in a mindset of hopefulness and saying, yes, we can. Here's the money to support that, back that up. Now it is up to you to create charter schools that could be competitive and rethink, because I'm a teaching artist. And so my whole thing is that as artists, theater artists, and many people who are in that same community here in New York, we're in the process of coupling what is being taught in the classroom with the child's passion. Teaching math, learning music, so they can write their own songs later on tracks, and realize that it all works together. And in a discussion and talk back with Felicia Rashad, she said, it's important that we get back to these things and realize that you cannot strip the arts from education and feel that's going to create, critical thought and well-rounded people, especially in the African American community, where we have these huge, icons in music and athletics, but we're not drawing the connections to many people who do the same thing, who are not as big, but use their education to get there. And not that they did, but like really showing that there's support, that they go hand in hand, it's not separate, you know. LeBron James didn't just, you know, just become who he is because of sheer talent. He had to hone that. Someone had to help him hone that. So I feel that that through this presidency, there's the idea that we have an opportunity now and been given the support to do the work to fulfill the dream.
Hello, everyone. I just basically wanted to share a personal experience. Basically, my own experience, me migrating from Tanzania when I was about 15 months old. It's definitely given me a perspective that's kind of sort of a global perspective as far as, you know, what it actually means to be black in this country. Basically, migrating from Tanzania, I did elementary school while I was here, and just basically came up to high school as well, ended up going abroad to the United Kingdom. But what I'm trying to say is, in my eyes, is that the dream has been fulfilled in my eyes. And that's only because the struggles that I had to basically see and face were so, you know, they were so, you know, amazing that I had to basically, like, work hard. I had to work hard in school, but basically my spirit really was a driving force. And when you go abroad and you see students who basically don't have as much opportunity or as much resources at their fingertips as students here in America, I think it's amazing that, I think it's, you have to note that Barack Obama being in the position that he is today and where he came from is quite an achievement. Basically, you know, I had an opportunity to vote for the first time at age 29. So, I mean, getting my citizenship and all that sort of thing was an amazing thing, but we just have to remember, for ourselves that, you know, African Americans, we all have a challenge that's very similar. We have a challenge that we have to basically look at and use all our resources, not just resources here in the United States and experiences here in the United States, but pull our resources that are in Africa and in other developing countries. Because what they have to work with is a lot less than what African Americans have to work with here in this country. And I understand the pressures and the stigma because I also get bought into that too. Being from abroad and having an experience where people don't have much, and then coming here, and it's almost like you have resources at your fingertips, you know, it's party all the time and all that sort of thing. But when you come out into the real world, you would have that expectation. And now looking at this global recession that we've been in, I almost feel as if, wow, something has been owed to me. But I know that my spirit, the spirit that I came with, has not left. And you have to basically use that and find avenues where you can use your resources into certain different things. It doesn't have to necessarily mean that an education is the only thing that basically makes you who you are. Your education basically is a foundation, and that foundation gives you an opportunity to use your gifts and talents to make a change in your community. So basically that's where I'm coming from, and I hope that my experience inspires everyone else, because Barack Obama being in the position that he's in, it has caused inspiration, and I think it's mostly been his spirit that has guided him to be who he is. So
we'll take two more. I think we have time for two more, and we're going to be on this side.
I got you.
I just wanted to take a few questions back and go back to what she said earlier about tests in high school, I completely agree with you. Completely. I have had the experience of both public and private high school, so I can see where you're coming from in high school. I remember in high school, the teachers would focus solely on one test, FCAT. Now, when that test came and gone, what else is there now? They didn't teach us anything else but what was going to be on that test. And that test doesn't build character. It doesn't show you how to, when you graduate from college, it's not going to show you what to do out there. And coming from private school, where the majority of the teachers are teaching, yes, towards a test, but also towards what you're going to need for college, what you're going to need for after college, what you're going to need next year. And I have to say that public school, there are some teachers in public school who, like you also said, teachers who really care about their students. And those are the teachers that I really, truly learn from. Not just what was bubble A, bubble C. Not just that. So.
I wanted to add on to what you guys were saying about the whole education and testing thing, because I have been in private school for all of my high school career so far. I'm a junior now. But I think that having standardized tests is a good thing, but it's not, it's way overrated. Completely overrated. Because this high school is more than just about learning facts and learning how to do stuff, and they take out what they want, what people want to do, like art, music, recess.
One last comment.
First of all, I agree with what everybody has been saying about the educational piece. We're in a disaster right now educationally, and our kids are the ones suffering, and we've got to do something different. But to go back to the original question, has the dream been fulfilled? The morning after the election, I was on my way to work, and I'm driving up Connecticut Avenue, and I just broke out in tears. And I know that happened to a lot of us, because we were happy, we were a little bit afraid, you know, it was a lot of different emotions. I mean, not me, my parents. Yeah. But stupid stuff for stupid reasons. So there was a fear in my heart for him, for his family, because of those kind of people. But to even ask the question of whether or not the dream has been realized, to me, it's not even close. The dream has not been realized. We've made President Obama, and his success has been a great incentive for this country, not just African Americans, but for everybody for a lot of different reasons. But we're not even close to realizing the dream. And I think if Martin Luther King Jr. were alive today, he would tell us, no, that's not my dream. That's part of it. That's a big step. That's a step in the right direction. But like you said, you look at the educational disparities, you look at the financial disparities, you look at all of the housing disparities that we see, prisons. There's no way that the dreams have been realized yet. But I think one of the biggest things, the biggest impact of Barack Obama being elected president is that now he becomes a role model for our children and all children in this country. Like I said, not just black kids, but he becomes the ultimate role model for them because now they're not just looking at rap stars and athletes and maybe their parents, hopefully, as a role model, but they're looking beyond that and saying, wow, I can actually be president one day and work hard and do what I got to do. But it also, I think he's also a great role model for non-African-American people because they see now, like, well, maybe my concept of African-Americans was a little off. I didn't think a black person could become president or was smart enough to be president. Maybe I was a little off in my thinking, so I'll adjust my thinking. So I think it's going to improve everybody in this country to some degree, but we still got a long way to make that dream happen.
Of course, Michelle Obama is a wonderful role model as well, okay. And she's going to have a great impact. Okay.
Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much, and thanks for your participation.